So good morning, friends and colleagues, and welcome. Thank you for joining us today. And welcome to the Johnson Sharma Graduate School Public Policies Public Lecture Series. For this lecture, the school has had the good fortune with partnering for the Faculty of Nurse and the Saskatchewan Midwives Association. And we're really, really looking forward to today. My name is Kathleen McNutt. I'm the director of the Johnson Sharma School at the University of Regina campus, and I'm going to be your moderator for today's event. As many of you know, the Johnson Sharma is one school with two campuses, so I would also like to extend a warm welcome to our colleagues and guests at the University of Saskatchewan, which you can see up there. And the event there will be moderated by my good friend and colleague, Keith Walker. Keith, can you hear us okay? Thumbs up? Okay, thank you. Thank you. So today we're extremely pleased to welcome Professor Ivy Bourgault, who has joined us to discuss a critical policy issue in Saskatchewan and across Canada, and this is midwifery. When midwifery first became legal in Saskatchewan in 2009, and there is currently a significant shortage of registered midwives in the province. So I'm really looking forward to her talk today. You can't be just a little bit pregnant. A systems view of midwifery policy and practice in Canada. And to formally introduce her, I would like to turn it over to another colleague of mine, Professor David Gregory, who is the Dean of Nursing.
Thank you very much, Kathy.
Good morning, colleagues. Here in this room and up in Saskatoon, we're delighted that you're able to join us today for this event. A thank you to the Johnson Sharma Graduate School of Public Policy, as well as the Midwives Association of Saskatchewan for co-sponsoring this event. Dr. Bourgault, we are absolutely delighted that you are gracing us with your presence here today, and importantly, we are looking forward very much to your lecture and the information contained therein. Dr. Bourgault is a professor in the Telfer School of Management and Institute of Population Health at the University of Ottawa. She is also a CIHR chair in Gender, Work, and Human Health Resources. Dr. Bourgault is the scientific director of the Pan-Ontario Population Health Improvement Research Network and the Health Human Resource Research Network. Both of these networks are housed at the University of Ottawa. Dr. Bourgault has served as a consultant to various provincial ministries of health across Canada, to Health Canada, and to the World Health Organization. Her recent research focuses on the migration of health professionals and their integration into the Canadian healthcare system. Dr. Bourgault is on the International Editorial Board of Sociology and Health and Illness and the Journal of Marketing and Management in Healthcare. She is a member of the Institute Advisory Board of the CIHR Institute of Health Services and Research Policy. She is also the co-founder of the Bilingual Canadian Society for the Sociology of Health. Of interest, Dr. Bourgault's PhD and postdoctoral work focused on the integration of midwifery in Ontario and Canada, respectively. She is a highly accomplished and acclaimed researcher and scholar, and we take great delight in having you here this morning, Dr. Bourgault. Bienvenue à l'Université de Regina. Please join me in extending a warm welcome to Dr. Bourgault.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for coming out for the talk, and to the folks in Saskatchewan. I just want to make sure that I've turned my mic on and you guys can hear me. Nods or thumbs up? Great. Okay. Excellent. Well, I really, really appreciate the invitation. I love speaking about midwifery, and I love speaking in Saskatchewan. I'm a Saskatchewan girl. Some of you may know the place where I'm from, but if you don't, that's acceptable, because it was Marsland, Saskatchewan, and the sign when we used to live here boasted population 303. So if you blink your eyes on the way from Saskatoon to PA, you've missed it. And there's a lot of different reasons why I'm pleased also to provide this lecture, and I'm hoping that it can spark some interest and impetus in terms of moving things forward. I'll give you a little bit of an introduction in terms of the title that I've chosen, and some of you who have read in the midwifery area know that midwifery scholars love to use puns, birth puns. The name of my book that came from my thesis was called Push, It was really quite strategic because midwives were pushing for something new, but it's also what you do when you're pregnant or having a baby. Reconceiving Midwifery was the other book that we did, but I have other colleagues who have used labor pains, midwives in passage, a variety of different things. So about not being a little bit pregnant is really my argument that you need to have a critical mass. You need to have a critical mass from a policy systems perspective if you really want to change maternity care. And so doing things in very sort of small measures, I think it has been tested in other provinces, and I think what we need now are really bold moves. And so that's what the argument that I'm going to be making. So just to give you an overview, I'm planning on speaking for approximately 45 minutes. I really want to take the opportunity, because I'm here in person and also video linked with colleagues in Saskatchewan, to have a conversation. And the slide deck is really, to give you an overview, a prime that conversation. Because I've provided links to many resources in the slide. We'll start off first with what are midwives and how do midwives practice here in Canada, and how that is, really quite unique in contrast to in other jurisdictions. What is the state of midwifery legislation and practice and education in particular? Education, you will see the growing of new midwives, the continuation of this profession, you will see will be a key theme that I want to highlight. Economics of midwifery, because that seems to be the stumbling block all the time, and I want to bring some data and reframe the conversation actually about the economics of midwifery, and then talk about place of birth and place of work, because midwives are working in unique places as well. So midwives in Canada are primary healthcare providers. That's really important to notice. To note that they are autonomous. They work with others, of course, so they are not independent, but they work autonomously. Okay, so that's why we use the term primary care providers. They're the first point of contact. You don't necessarily need to get a referral. You can go to a midwife directly. They care for women during pregnancy, birth, and up to 6 weeks postpartum. That up to 6 weeks postpartum can be extended in certain jurisdictions, okay? But this is largely what we refer to as midwife's scope of practice. This is what they do, okay? And then we're going to talk about how they do that, okay? Because it's a unique model of practice. That is the title that gets used in Canada, or the description that gets used in Canada by the Canadian Institute of Health Information. A colleague, Judith Rooks, a nurse midwife who's written many textbooks on midwifery in the United States, has a bit of an additional dimension that she wants to highlight about what midwives do. They are experts in promoting, protecting, supporting, enhancing normal physiological birth. Okay. Labor, delivery, and breastfeeding. So those elements of protection, promotion of normal birth, normalizing birth, really being the appropriate care provider for the bulk of women who have low-risk pregnancies, births, and postpartum period. Okay? And if you look at internationally, midwives are the primary care provider for women who have low-risk pregnancy and births. The model of midwifery care in Canada, there are some slight variations across Canada, but these are some elements that are really quite common across the provinces. You're probably familiar, we have federal, provincial, territorial health systems, so there isn't sort of one midwifery legislation. It goes across the different provinces because of this being a provincial territorial jurisdiction. All registered midwives in Canada are primary care providers who typically work in groups, either work in pairs, or if they are in rural and remote locations, they can work with other health care providers. They could be working with a family physician, a nurse, or nurse practitioner as backup, but they largely work in group practices. they have the following criteria, and many of these criteria are written into their provincial legislation. The issue of continuity of care, that they provide care during pregnancy, labor, postpartum period. You will see your midwife or the two midwives that you're working with, and if it's a large group practice, there may be more than two midwives that you get to know. But that continuity of care was seen as being really important for establishing trust, relationships, and so there's a lot of research around continuity of care, not just in Canada, but in other jurisdictions. The duration of care is that they stay throughout the birth, right? So they aren't they are on call. So I suspect there might be some midwives having to leave during the presentation. So they're on call because they're there for the whole time throughout your birth. They don't sort of come in, do 8 hours, and then hand off to somebody else. Okay, so they're for the duration of care. Choice of birthplace being very important, and the alternatives we'll talk about a little bit more detail later. Offering the choice of home birth, being able and comfortable to practice in those settings and having the competencies to practice in those settings, as well as in hospital and in some cases birth center. And we'll talk a little bit more about birth centers. High quality care, high quality evidence-based care, that really is about ensuring that that the client, the women who are pregnant or in birth, in labor, are informed about the different options that they have, and they are the ultimate decider, that they are ultimately responsible. So it's really, in Ontario, they talk about sort of the midwife following the woman, midwife providing the advice, providing that expert advice, and the woman with her family being the one making the decision. Continuity of care throughout labor and delivery, and stipulations, and these are often written into regulations about requirements for consultation and transfer of care to physicians, whether that be to family physicians or to specialists, the obstetrician gynecologist. And that those types of standards are written in consultation with family physician groups and obstetrical colleagues. This is an overview of midwifery legislation across Canada as of 2012. And you can see Saskatchewan there in 2008, 2009. And so this is a table that I've pulled out of a chapter that colleagues have prepared for a textbook that we're doing. We're crafting a textbook on Introduction to Health Occupations in Canada. There's no such textbook, so this is from a chapter that's been drafted about midwives. And so this gives you a sense of the legislation, whether or not there's public funding. Initially, when we did this table a while back, there was legislation but no public funding, for example, in Alberta, which was a very perplexing situation. And now there is some form of public funding in that province. What the employment status is, in some cases midwives are salaried, in some cases they're independent contractors through their group practice. So there can be different models, and that also depends on how midwives have been integrated into the system. Do they have a direct contract with the Ministry of Health or Department of Health, or are they do they have a contract or salary arrangement, employment arrangement, which with regional health authorities it really can differ. In large part, their funding or their remuneration is per course of care, and this will give you a sense of the number of midwives. Ontario being the first province to have legislation which took effect December 31st, 1993, so that's why we end up saying 1994, having roughly 680 midwives. Now, we also have issues with how do we count midwives, because do we count FTEs, full-time equivalents of midwives, because a lot of midwives may have their license, may not be practicing, or may be practicing part-time, because midwives are largely women. There are a couple male midwives, and but they tend to also be giving birth at the same time, so there are some of them off on maternity leave. So when we get when we have a total of over 1,000 midwives, it's still not quite, you know, a full course. I highlighted the row for New Brunswick because I just want to talk about that as a cautionary tale. Midwifery education is expanding. This is great to see because for the longest time there were only the programs in Ontario. Ontario really is one program offered through three universities with a lot of connections, so probably very similar to the School of Public Policy here where you have two campuses. It's like that. So they have been operating for a number of years. They had their 20th anniversary last year. They produced a video. And so they have initially started with fewer midwives, so they're up to 90 midwives in total, but it used to be across the campuses from 40, so they really tried to ramp that up. But there is the issue around education is that there is a bit of a bottleneck because midwifery education requires midwifery preceptors, and so if you don't have enough midwives to supervise the students, you know, it can be quite challenging. And so I think if there can be some type of interprovincial agreements around sharing resources, because midwives largely, I mean, even in Ontario, they're largely in their communities and they're learning by distance education. So whether or not you're calling into one place or another place, it really doesn't matter so much. So it's growing, and the reason why I sort of highlight Manitoba is that is, again, another cautionary tale. Because there was a University College of the North with the projection that they would be graduating 8 to 10 students per year, but as of yet, or as of 2010, they hadn't graduated any. Kelly Thiessen is a colleague, and they are looking to establish a midwifery education program at the University of Manitoba. And her thesis was looking at the case of midwifery in Manitoba as being stalled development, largely because of the lack of an educational program. And so I think similar parallels can be seen here. If you've put all of the time and energy into creating legislation for a profession, without there being a consequent education program to regenerate the profession, it seems to be a lot of resources without the kind of follow-through that you need. So an educational program is critically important, and as I get later on into my talk, I will show how critically important it is for there to be many more midwives, many more midwifery educational programs, because the Canadian system of maternity care is really improperly tooled. Anyway, so let me continue. I've already sold the rest of my lecture to you. So here were the targets that they had in Manitoba. They said by 2005, they were projecting that there would be 140 practicing midwives in the province. And in Ontario, we were looking to Manitoba as like really, even though that they would have a smaller number because of the population and the birth rate, that midwives in Manitoba were going to have a much bigger share of the maternity care pie, as it may, in Manitoba, and that just didn't happen. And it was largely because of the lack of an education program. So they were hoping to have 140 by 2010, or 2005. As of 2010, they had 38 practicing midwives, and midwifery attended births were still in the range of 5%. And I understand here in Saskatchewan, they're in the range of about 4%. Okay. And so when you talk about internationally how most births in high-income, middle-income, low-income countries are attended by midwives, we're not talking 5%, we're not talking 40%, we're talking 80% of births are attended by midwives, then you start to wonder what's going on and how can we, you know, how can we shift that? In New Brunswick is a similar story as we've seen in other Eastern jurisdictions, Newfoundland is another one, of stalled implementation. And the reason why I kind of pick on New Brunswick a little bit is because this became an election issue. Midwifery funding became an election issue. Midwives were argued to be a costly add-on to the system, and this was essentially for four midwives in a group practice that this was going to cost. And it was the way that it was framed. It wasn't $760,000. It was $750,000. That was how people said it. And so when you say it in that way, you go, oh my God, we don't have the money to spend on that. And from, you know, when I'm asked about this, you know, I sigh because I'm going, okay, yet another economic analysis of midwifery where you add up what you're going to pay midwives and how you're going to implement this. And yes, you know, a startup is typically more costly at the beginning, any kind of startup company. You know, I'm sitting in a school of management now, and I'm becoming more familiar with this type of terminology, right? Startups will be costly, but when I was asked about this, and I did an interview recently with White Coat Black Art, very well done set of questions that Brian Goldman had asked, I said, just once I'd like to be asked how costly it is not to have midwives. And it's really important to reframe the question that way. Because if all of you are thinking about it is like how much money I'm going to have to put into a system to create, you know, a new way of doing things, but if that's the way that one should be doing things, shouldn't you get started on that? Right? I mean, no one's talking about the other costs of not having midwives. So I want to talk about that other side of the equation for a little bit. This is an older chart that I got from a colleague, Stan Lofsky, and it was looking at maternity care in Ontario. The chart basically looks the same, you know, in terms of slope and direction across all the provinces. Basically, what it's saying here is the number of healthcare providers who are doing intrapartum care, delivering, like this is the issue, right? It's not so much prenatal and postnatal, it's like who's available to actually do the births. So the number of family physicians doing intrapartum care plummets. And this was just even going to 2003. Obstetricians, you know, yes, the same number of them are doing intrapartum care, absolutely. And then the midwives are increasing because there are increasing midwives, but the slope of midwives going up is just not going to capture the slope of family physicians going down. So what do you think happens in this circumstance where you have fewer family physicians doing birth, not enough midwives to pick up the slack per se, and you have obstetricians who are there? What do you think is happening? Any guesses? You have more obstetricians delivering low-risk births, right? Because family physicians are not really referring to midwives, and midwives don't need referrals anyway because they're turning women away at the door, right? I suspect that that's happening here in Saskatchewan as it is in pretty much every jurisdiction. Okay, so because of this decision of family physicians, and that's a whole other conversation we have about why family physicians are not doing intrapartum care, whole other conversation, but that is what's happening. And so from a system perspective, our system, you know, which initially had family physicians doing low-risk maternity care, we have obstetrician doing higher volume, high-risk care. So what are the consequences? So you don't have enough midwives, more and more obstetricians attending low-risk births. And the important thing is to understand and appreciate what these different healthcare providers do. Yes, obstetricians can attend deliveries, right? That's what they're trained to do. Midwives attend deliveries, absolutely. But they are trained in a very different way. They're trained to be a different type of healthcare provider. Obstetricians are trained to take care of women who have very high-risk pregnancies, right? And they're the most appropriate provider for them. And they have excellent results, absolutely excellent results. But are they the best care provider, most appropriate care provider from a systems perspective to approach low-risk care? So this is what needs to be problematized, okay? So from a systems perspective, there's a growing mismatch between the approach required and the approach that is being applied. And it's not that we designed the system this way, it's just that the system has responded because of the human resources issues in terms of the number of family physicians not doing maternity care. So this is when I talk about, is this the right tool for the job? Okay? Are we doing like Harry here? Okay? Not doing it the right way. So could we ask, should obstetricians be primarily the attendants in low-risk births? They're trained and managed to be very vigilant, and vigilant in a way that is usually interventive. That approach is appropriate when you're looking at high-risk pregnancies. The evidence is not as supportive in an interventive approach for low-risk pregnancies. Okay? Midwives, by way of contrast, are a more appropriate healthcare provider, a better tool, as it may, not that I'm calling midwives tools, but midwives are a more appropriate model, you know, to approach this. You know, we talk about the philosophy of midwifery-led care being the focus on normal, and that they're vigilant in a way that is often time-consuming in vigilance. They are watchful, waiting in watchfulness, right? It's a different approach that requires a certain set of skills. There are times when you should not be doing something, that's what the evidence suggests. Not doing something can be a very challenging decision, okay? So it's really important on that. So again, philosophy behind birth on normality, emphasis on one's natural ability with minimum intervention. So it's not to say no intervention, and no one, not even a midwife, would argue that you should have no intervention. It's the appropriateness of intervention, and typically where there is evidence to suggest that that's appropriate. So more about the consequences. This is what has been happening to our cesarean section rates. And this is only going into the early 2000s. I actually tried to find a trend diagram to take us into the most recent time period. But I will let you know that it has been increasing quite rapidly since then. There's a very interesting story about the dip in the 1990s that happened there. There were some very strong cases about the appropriateness of using cesarean sections, and so there was a much more attenuated use of C-sections, and that has seemed to have that sort of conservative nature, the conservative use of cesarean sections has gone out the window, which is really quite unfortunate. These are the latest data from the CHI-HI report that was released in June. So they talk about the top five reasons for inpatient surgeries. So these are the ones that one would typically think, right? We have an aging population, right? Knee replacement, hip replacement, hysterectomy, coronary artery dilation. These are the numbers across Canada. What do you think is number one? C-sections. Do you want to see by how much? That shocked even me. It's almost twice as much as the second, knee replacements and hip replacements. Do we pay any attention to this? No. Okay, so we need to start paying attention to this. Because do you know what's costly? Inappropriate cesarean sections. Okay? So I want to bust a myth, first of all, because people say, well, you know, the reason why those cesarean sections arise is because all of those older women demanding to have their C-sections at a certain period of time, blah, blah, blah. So we did this. We busted this myth. So C-sections are on the rise because more mothers are asking for them. This is the cartoon. And the demographics of the woman who has gray hair is talking about the older women having children. And so the obstetrician says, you're due on the 17th. I'm all booked that week. Let's go on the 4th. How does 1 p.m. sound? Okay. So this is a myth that actually gets propagated. And when you actually look at the evidence, which we did, it's largely because clinical practice guidelines are not being consistently implemented. Clinical practice guidelines around labor induction, around vaginal birth after cesarean section, and around dystocia. There is a much more interventive approach to those, And the midwifery literature has talked a lot about sort of the cascade of interventions. As soon as you start doing something, it's more likely that something else is going to happen. Right? If you have labor, your labor induced, and they talk about inducing labor for post dates, but if you're not quite post date, but you know, but we can slot you into the hospital at this time, this is how there's a slippery slope. I just want to digress for a moment on this work that we did with Markham Stouffville Hospital in Ontario. Markham Stouffville is a fairly wealthy neighborhood, suburb of Toronto, fairly high high income, very and a lot of immigrants, wealthier immigrants, and so they had a problem that they had a rising C-section rate and rising induction rates. Their C-section rate in 2005 was 25%, and then it was inching up to 30%. they also found that there were these inappropriate inductions being done for post-dates. So instead of booking a woman in for 41 and 3 days post-date, they were being booked, and some of them were being done when they were 40 weeks, and in some cases in 39 weeks. And so there was this slippery slope, and there was no evidence base for that. In fact, the evidence was suggesting the alternative. And there are very few women choosing to do a trial of labor after a previous cesarean section. The context there is that they were having increasing birth volume, they were building a new hospital, their community is growing, but there was no projected increase in funding. So they, a challenge was put to them by their finance department, said, this is how much money we can give you. You either stick to the birth volumes that you have or you do things differently. And so they got together an interprofessional team that developed what we called their care strategy, cesarean reduction strategy. And they had a variety of different policies that were to intervene in the pathway to C-section. Okay, so there are factors that the healthcare provider has, the mother, the baby. Induction can sometimes lead to C-sections, but there is a way to contrast that by going through VBACs. And so there were a variety of different little policies that they put in place. We called it a multiple intervention strategy because they didn't just target women with an education campaign. They didn't just approach women who had a previous cesarean section to have them consider a trial of labor. They didn't just have all of the healthcare providers on side and each of them owned their cesarean section rate. They didn't just put a chart up at the front of the hospital that said this is this month's C-section rate and this is this month's induction rate. They did all of those things, okay? And they made it public and transparent. And this is what they did. In the space of rolling this out over 16 months, they got their C-section rate from 30% down to their target was 25. Now, what's very interesting is we've taken these data and we've compared them to other similar hospitals in Ontario, and it's almost the exact opposite. The C-section rate has gone up in those other hospitals, so there wasn't a general community trend going on here. It was what they decided to do at this hospital. And so we're working with other hospitals to take this innovation, which isn't particularly innovative, it's just doing evidence-based care, taking this package and translating it to other hospitals who are also concerned. And so we have more information at this website that we've created called Pushing for the Best Choice, which was the name of their campaign, so we use that. So C-section, so why do we want to reduce C-sections? Why did they do that at Markham Stouffville Hospital? Because they're costly. Okay, a C-section costs $4,600 compared to $2,800 for a vaginal birth in hospital. Okay? So there's not just the cost of how much a C-section costs for the physician fee versus a vaginal birth for the physician fee, if we're just doing physicians. There's the operating room space. There's the anesthetist. There's nursing care, longer hospital stay. And this isn't even calculating the follow-up effects of care after cesarean section that is largely borne privately by the woman and their family. About, you know, having difficulty breastfeeding, not being able to get up and take care of other kids, having family members having to come over, all of those kinds of things. And there's a very interesting little piece in the Healthy Debate website on so pulling back the curtain on rising cesarean section rates. So I encourage that. If you look at specific evaluations here in Canada that they've done in Ontario, they found that midwifery care in contrast to family doctors. So they were contrasting low risk with low risk, not low risk with high risk. So when you compare midwives for low-risk women by family doctors, a 38% lower cesarean section rate, 60% fewer instrumental-assisted births, double the number of women discharged within 48 hours, and lower maternal newborn hospital readmission rates. Okay? Those are all the data that they have in Ontario. If you look at broadly, this is a Cochrane review. So when you're talking about reviewing of evidence and whether or not you want to criticize the evidence hierarchy that the Cochrane Review says, this is the strongest evidence that you can get. The Cochrane Review that they did is midwifery care is associated with fewer instrumental assisted births, lower cesarean section rates, and reduced hospital stays. And their argument is that most women should be offered midwifery-led models of care. Not because this is the soft, fluffy thing to do. It's not about, you know, beautiful curtains on the walls and water births and music. If you're just interested in costs, that's the reason why. So when you translate the Ontario data, you would save, hospital midwifery births would save $800 per birth, in contrast to family physician. Attending low-risk women, so we're looking at the comparators here, and $1,800 in home deliveries. So we've talked about midwifery in hospital and hospital-led units. I don't want to get into a debate here about the safety of hospital or home births. That's a whole other conversation, which I hope we don't have to have. This is a link to the Canadian Association of Midwives position statement on home birth, which links to some of the highest impact journals who have done reviews on the safety of home birth, both in Canada, United States, and other high-income countries. So I'm hoping that that's not the issue. Doesn't matter, though, really what you say about the safety of home birth. Women are still largely going to choose to go into hospital, and that's just the trends. But it really is important to ensure that you have the option of home birth available for women. So I want to talk a little bit about birth centers. So birth centers were really the only place that midwives could practice in Quebec. It's the reason why they have 17. And they call them the Maison de Naissance. And they really do look just like houses. They're absolutely, you know, very, they're integrated into communities. They're very much houses. I'm going to come back to the Ontario story in a minute. Alberta, I understand, has two birth centers in Calgary and Edmonton. Again, very home-like settings. In Manitoba, they've opened a birth center through the Women's Health Clinic, a little bit more institutional than you would say the Quebec Maison. The Ontario story is very interesting. I was involved with the Toronto Birth Center Committee when I was a graduate student and had my first baby, my daughter. So, I mean, I measure everything about with the height and age of my eldest daughter. And so she's 23 and 6 feet tall and doing a graduate degree in England. And so that's really how long it took for the Toronto Birth Center to open, because they really did just open earlier this year. So when we had, were initially to open, now the Toronto Birth Center Committee had existed 20 years prior to my getting involved. I mean, this is a committee that had been around since the late 1970s. And they were committed to opening a publicly funded center because they had fundraised and could have opened a private clinic anytime. But we were committed to be in a publicly funded model. So in 1992-93, there was a call for proposals. They were going to establish four birth centers in the province. We submitted a proposal, 800-page proposal. I still have it, although it's a very painful document to keep. So we were one of four winning bids, and we were in the process of we were only able to lease a place. And we had designed the whole thing. It was being renovated. And all of the work that goes into establishing a birth center All of our legal advice was pro bono. All of our architectural advice was pro bono. I had essentially crafted a research program pro bono as a graduating PhD student. All of that volunteer labor, it was decided when the new conservative government came in that they were going to cancel all of it. And not for any, it wasn't for any economic reason, because we presented the economic data, that we had at the time, which basically said that they were, that at steady state you would save $1,800 per birth in the birth center, but it was cut. And so for 20 years that kind of languished. The new government, one of the newer governments that we had recently sent out a proposal to establish two birth centers. So I'm going, woo, I waited 20 years for half the birth centers. So, and the Minister of Health at the time was someone that I knew from the University of Western Ontario. And she was very much supportive of midwifery. Her daughter had been attended by a midwife. Our new Minister of Health is a midwifery client. And so there are two birth centers in Toronto and Ottawa. Ottawa asked me to be involved, and I said that was too painful, and so I had one of my students involved with that. So she had a really great experience helping them write a proposal that was winning. And we're hopeful that Ontario will be a little bit bolder than two birth centers very soon. That's my little painful story about birth centers. And I wanted to also really highlight the importance of birth centers or community-based birthing services for Aboriginal communities. And I have an Aboriginal midwife working with me on her PhD, so she's going to be doing some work with Norway House to look at some of the work that they've been doing there. In Ontario, we have a clause in the regulation that allows someone to call themselves an Aboriginal midwife to work in First Nations communities and not necessarily be a registered midwife. And this is to acknowledge that there are community ways to train and to, you know, certify of sorts an Aboriginal midwife. And so although there are some registered midwives who are also Aboriginal midwives, many of the midwives who practice in these midwifery practices on First Nations communities are not necessarily registered midwives. So we may actually have more midwives than we count. But that differs by different provinces and jurisdictions. But Aboriginal midwifery practices, I think, are really important to for those communities, as it is important to maintain birth in rural communities that are not necessarily Aboriginal. Having birth in the community is a very important procedure. So if we get in terms of the issue, in terms of the place and the value of work of midwives, as I mentioned earlier, because we need to redesign the Canadian maternity care system because of the historical legacies of the exclusion or non-integration of midwives, there will be some startup costs that will be involved to reorganize, retool the system of maternity care. But this is kind of like the couple that have the Porsche, and they have a very nice, high quality car, and they need to retool because they now have five children. They need to buy a minivan. So this is what you need to do. So we need to kind of shift that a little bit. So there is some startup costs. There are startup costs, for crafting birth centers as well. But again, you need to look at steady state. You need to look at long-term projections. And sometimes that's a difficult decision to make politically if budgets are tight, and we all appreciate that we're in an austerity environment, but we do need to invest in the long term. I also want to really stress that it's important not to cut costs in the system or not to implement midwifery entirely or only thinking of this as a cost-cutting measure. Because essentially what you're doing is you're cutting costs on the backs of midwives, right? And I think we really do need to pay attention to the mounting data on the challenges that there are in being midwives. We have some challenges in terms of retention rate of women in the midwifery profession. And it's also important to abide by pay equity considerations when you're implementing midwifery. And I say this not just for midwifery, I say it for all types of tasks shifting from one provider group to another provider group. You know, you want to do that in a way that's respectful of the training and the inputs and the competency of those professionals. So not to say, oh, we can save so much money by having midwives doing 40 births. Well, maybe we could save even more by having them doing 80 births, right, a year. And so I think it's you need to be really cognizant of that. So it's a bit of a caution about, you know, when you make the case for midwifery, make the economic case. I've written about the work lives of midwives, you know, being on call and what that is like. And it's interesting how with the one unique model of midwifery care, which is excellent, I think we need to start, as we grow the profession, for there to be different models of care for midwives for us to be able to retain those high quality and that expertise. So while midwives who are women who are having children, maybe there's a different model of care that they can practice by. So I think we need to kind of hybridize that model a little bit. And that's, you know, saying that from a consumer's perspective, being very grateful for the continuity of care that I had with the midwives, but also appreciating that I would not feel comfortable burning out midwives, you know, because of that model. So I think that there does need to be some flexibility there. So that's why I say you can't just be a little bit pregnant. You know, if you really want midwifery to work, if you want to avoid those back of the envelope economic arguments about, oh my God, it's going to cost an extra $750,000 for midwives and we simply don't have the money, I would like you to argue the other case of not having midwives and not having enough midwives in the system. So we clearly need midwifery. We clearly need more midwives, and the way to get that is through educational programs. And there are efficient ways that we can do that by linking up the different programs. I think we need to think beyond the provincial boundaries, and the Agreement on Internal Trade is making it a requirement that we look beyond provincial boundaries to how we train and share the health human resources that we have across our provinces. So I would encourage, if there is interest and appetite to establish a midwifery education program here in Saskatchewan, to go bold, you know, because we need a lot of them, and we can pick them up in Ontario as well. So thank you so much.